Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party. For the first time in the history of the show, I'm doing a replay season where I repeat some of the best interviews from the history of the show. It's been going 10 years. Now, if you're not aware why I'm doing this, it's not out of laziness. It's because I'm in hospital. I'm having an operation for a tumour on my spine. I'm not recording this on the ward. I've recorded this in advance, and I just thought I would go back through the back catalogue and pick out my favourite ones. Now, often people will get in touch by email, by Twitter, face to face, and say, oh, why haven't you had someone on? And I'll often say, I have, but you are forgiven, because it was a very long time ago, and I don't expect you to trawl through 10 years worth of podcasts. So I've picked out these. They're not in date order. They are in just a kind of fairly random order, but I've been through the entire feed and picked out my favourite ones. I had to start with this one because whenever I'm asked who the best guest I've ever interviewed is, there is only one answer, and it's Tessa Jowell. This is from September 2014, so 9 years ago. And whenever I'm preparing for these interviews, obviously you have a view, or I have a view, and you have a view as a listener. You think, oh, I've heard of that person, or I haven't. And you, if you have, you bring a preconception about them. You think, oh, that'll be funny, or that'll be interesting, or whatever it is. I'd always been a fan of Tessa Jowell, as you would guess from my politics, and just from her approach to it and her approach to life. I was not prepared to be moved in the way that I was by this. And I don't think anyone there on the night was prepared. And I get so many comments about this interview to this day, 9 years later. And it is purely because of the amazing person that Tessa Jowell is. I can't bring myself to say was, because this is a record of her and her personality that is so special. And this is the closest thing to a spiritual experience I've ever had. And this was a special moment in my life because of Tessa and because of who she was. And whenever people get cynical about politicians, there are plenty of politicians out there that prove that cynicism wrong. And hopefully you can think of many. But top of that list for me, after this interview, has always been Tessa Jowell. So enjoy just the most magical evening in the history of the show. And I couldn't start this replay season with anyone else. This is the magical Tessa Jowell.
We've got a very special guest this evening, and with it being Labour Party Conference Week, highly relevant as well. This evening's guest is someone that I've been a huge fan of for many, many years, and to my opinion was undoubtedly one of the greatest talents of the New Labour era, and was someone that I always hoped would run for the leadership. And I think it's made such a huge contribution. Not many politicians that aren't Prime Minister can really point to a huge legacy. So many ministers will be happy with some obscure act from 1989 that they steered, something through. Tessa Jowell's legacy is absolute. It's the 2012 Olympics. Without her, it absolutely wouldn't have happened. She wasn't a bit part player. She had to convince the cabinet. It was her idea, and she saw it through. And even the Conservatives, Lib Dems, and every party really fully accepts that it was all thanks to her. It's a phenomenal thing to have achieved, as well as everything else. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive reception for Dame Tessa Jowell. Have a seat. So you've been in Manchester this week for the conference?
I have. I went up on Saturday for the day and I came back, and then I went up again on Monday morning and I came back very late last night.
And were you in the hall for Ed's speech?
I was indeed. In fact, I was sitting. I certainly was. In fact, I had the great honour, since I'm standing down at the next election, of being sat in the front row, as close to the podium as I am to you. And so I soaked up all the atmosphere. And I was sitting next to Doreen Lawrence. And we were trying to work out why we had this great honour conferred on us. And I said, I think we've got two jobs to do. One is to make sure we stand up and clap. The second is to smile a lot. And the third is not to go to sleep. And after about 20 minutes, she mistook my drooping head, which was actually focusing on the second of the six pledges to rebuild Britain.
And was that free insulation?
Suddenly I felt this elbow in my face. And I sat up like this. And that was reflecting on the second pledge.
It was funny when you watch it. They did a thing this year with the camera where people were sort of sat there in the audience, and the camera would run down the line and get loads of people's reactions, and you could see people sort of sat there like that and then immediately sort of come to life. Sadiq Khan smouldered. I've never seen a reaction like Sadiq Khan was sort of sat there like that, and then he noticed the cameras on him and immediately sort of went so went all James Bond. He was very cool.
Well, there's always you see, it used to be the case, you know, because I've done this for so long, it used to be the case that there was a kind of free-for-all for where you, if you were in the shadow cabinet and then you were in the cabinet, about where you sat. And it was like the blooming January sales, people getting there at about, you know, the conference hall would clear at about midday for the leader's speech starting at 2:30. And, you know, if you were a real keno and you wanted to be in the front row as a shadow cabinet member, this is circa, you know, pre-1997, you kind of take your sandwiches and your freshen up kit as you would sit there as in the front row. And then somebody would come along and move you and say the shadow chancellor had to sit there. So. It's all part of the ritual humiliation of politics that you have to get used to.
In terms of Ed's speech, it's had mixed reviews. Was it something that you thought... I mean, did it feel like a prime minister in waiting to you?
I think he's... keep it plausible, as Tony Blair would say. I mean, I think that it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and I think that there was a lot in the speech which, if we get elected, will have a huge... And we do it, will have a huge impact. I think that... I mean, there was something very odd and dead about the hall. Mm. And I think there had been a deliberate decision. It was going to be much more celebratory, but I think that a decision was taken not to be too triumphalist and so forth after Scotland. And one of the things, I think this was actually one of the things that had an effect on our conference, I think that the people who had really been there throughout the whole referendum campaign, and you know, you can say the thing about 2.5 years and so forth, I think that there was something almost like a sense of trauma about people, that the menace, the threatening behaviour, day in, day out, you know, the cyber gnats, the passion of the cause. And I think that that had in some way, found its way into the dynamic of the conference. So I think that, you know, it's fine to kind of, you know, join in the laughter of Ed's speech, you know, and the mockery by all the commentators who just basically have nothing more difficult to do than go out, buy lunch for somebody who they hope will then spill the beans and decide which bottle of wine. You know, this is, you know, what he's doing is serious. Mm. You know, he does want to be Prime Minister. He is absolutely convinced of the kind of argument and the way in which Britain can be a fairer place. And, you know, the kids in my constituency who are born into families that can offer them very little in terms of a kind of structure for their ambition, might actually be able to do what, you know, I always wanted my children to be able to do. And, you know, that's the great, you know, the great calling of politics. And so I think that a lot of what has been said and written is actually unfair. It will have gone by Monday, but what will remain are some very serious commitments and promises about how Britain could be different, and those will be offered to people next May, and they'll have to decide.
What's he like as a bloke, like, to deal with behind the scenes?
Ed?
Yeah.
Well, I've got... You see, I am a Blairite. I was a great supporter, great friend of Tony.
The best.
Top man.
Shouldn't be funny.
Top man. And I voted for David. You know, David and his wife Louise are very close friends of mine. But I do have a very simple view of this, which is that, you know, if you're a Member of Parliament and you're lucky enough to be a Member of Parliament, that your absolute obligation is to be loyal to the leader of the Labour Party, who has been elected by the Labour Party. And so loyalty is not a weak characteristic, it's a strong and essential characteristic. And without that, parties cannot thrive. And I've learnt an awful lot about this. I'm very interested in how you build sort of winning teams. Mm. And I mean, I felt that we did that with the Olympics, you know, the sense of team. Nobody was, except Boris actually, was kind of me, I'm the great champion. I'll tell you about Boris in a minute. But, you know, if you take someone like Dave Brailsford, you know, who, does everyone know who Dave Brailsford is? He's the British Cycling. And British Cycling have, you know, the team loyalty, you would never get Sir Chris Hoy dissing the technician who's just bound up, you know, one of his handlebars, or it's not even called a handlebar, but whatever, you know, whatever it is. Because the sense of, you know, if he did that, somehow that would be undermining the integrity and the strength of the team. And I feel the same about politics. Mm. You stand up for each other. You always recognise that there's enough success to go round. And you don't have to, you know, just because you're up doesn't mean somebody else is down, or they're up doesn't mean that you're rubbish. And, you know, that's one of the very destructive dynamics of politics, that actually, if you draw some lessons from sport, changes the behaviour. And you see, British Cycling have this... they have somebody who is... who's kind of authorised by the whole team to monitor winning behaviour and losing behaviour, building this sense of total team responsibility. And I think, you know, in government or in opposition, if you apply that discipline to yourself, then you're actually making a contribution and you increase the chance of the team winning. So we need that. We need that as a Labour Party. We need that as a parliamentary party, and we need that as a shadow cabinet. This sense of total unity of purpose and an absolute commitment to supporting winning and not you know, any of the other rather kind of dysfunctional behaviour that politics tends to, and, you know, frankly, that, you know, the diary pieces, and, you know, it's the kind of, this is the kind of cocaine of politics, you know. Oh, I got my name in the paper. Oh, I was the unnamed source, you know, all that kind of thing, which people get, you know, they get off on. I am alive. I'm on television. I am alive. My name is in the papers. And it's not like that. You know, that's not how teams win and flourish. And I think that we can take a lot from the success of some of those Olympic teams.
But you must have, at times, your loyalty tested. There must be some times where you're dealing with a leader.
Well, I think actually, I learned this from my daughter. My daughter, who's she's 32, 33, she's one of the most emotionally intelligent people I know, and she can say very tough things in a very kind way. And I've said some very tough things privately to Tony, to Gordon, and to Ed. But they're private, you know, so why would I talk about that? Because mm-hmm. I think that that's... sorry about that.
Because there's an hour left.
this was a dud booking, wasn't it?
So, like with Tony, I mean, that was... I always got the impression that he deliberately surrounded himself with people that would tell him the blunt truth, that he wanted to hear that, and maybe that was something that... was something that perhaps Gordon Brown didn't have in common with him. When you were frank with Tony about whatever it was, did he take it well?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. I was just thinking of a good example. I'll tell you a story. Does anyone remember the rather unsuccessful speech by the former Prime Minister to the Women's Institute? You all remember that? Right, well, that was my idea. That was my idea. This was our kind of incursion into Middle England, the audacity of the Labour Prime Minister going to address the Women's Institute. And so we set it all up, and, you know, that was fine. And I was to ride with him in the car, which is always quite exciting because of the outriders, you know, who ride their motorbikes like ballet dancers. I mean, it's the most incredible thing. And I did say to him once, shortly before he had to leave, was ousted from number 10 Downing Street, when we were going somewhere and it took all of 5 minutes to get from Downing Street to Westway in the rush hour, I said... if you're going for a train at Paddington, I'd allow a bit longer in the life thereafter. But anyway, so the Women's Institute speech, I remember we went up to, I had travelled with him in the car to Wembley, but I had to go and collect him beforehand from number 10 Downing Street. And he'd just come back from paternity leave because, you know, little Leo had just been born and he took 2 weeks off. And he'd written a speech that everyone had laughed at because it was all about the miracle of birth and nappies and, you know, breast milk and, you know, all that sort of thing. And, you know, so, you know, whoever it was who confronted him in number 10 had sort of taken this out of his hands, right, you're not doing that, torn it up, and written a speech about Labour's case for the National Health Service. And I did have a sense of unease, A, because nobody would let me see this speech, and B, that when I went to collect him, it was still being printed off the photocopier, which was quite a bad sign. And so he was delivered. He always had beautiful manners. He said, could you possibly just give me the speech? I think we have to be leaving now. And so the speech was put in his hand, and it was still warm, you know, from the printer. And
can you smell it?
What?
You know, when it's warm off the printer, people like to...
Yeah.
Did you ever do that?
No, we didn't on this occasion, actually. But anyway, then we got into the back of the car, and I just left him to read it, and his brow was a bit furrowed. And, you know, I'd remembered the names of, especially memorised the names of all the women that he was going to meet, so I introduced them all to him. And I remember we walked up these very narrow stairs and onto the stage at the Wembley Arena, which was absolutely, it was a sea of women's faces. He was introduced and he started his speech. And he talked about just coming back from paternity leave, and that was absolutely fine. And then he got on to a bit of Tory bashing and building Labour's case for the National Health Service. And I suddenly heard slow hand clapping, like, up there. And I was sitting behind. And it got louder and louder. I thought, no, that's not it. What? This can't be. And then people started shouting. This is the Women's Institute. And then live on Sky News. It was also live on Sky News. And everyone at number 10 was watching this disaster unfold. And there he was. I saw his back view, you know, as he tried. And, you know, remember, this is a Prime Minister who was adored wherever he went. But he'd walked into the Women's Institute. Anyway, so the whole thing became a complete bloody disaster. And there was slow hand clapping. He couldn't speak over the slow hand clapping. I was tempted at one moment, it's just as well I didn't, to go and take the microphone from him and say, don't be so rude to the Prime Minister. But I didn't think that would have gone down very well. Yeah. But anyway, but the point about did I ever tell him hard things, I was sent off to do all the media and explain why this had been a small triumph rather than a major disaster. And then Angie Hunter, who the legendary Angie Hunter, who looked after so much of what happened in those early days, always tells this story about how she got into the back of the car with him. And he, by his, this stage, he was looking so white and stony face. And she said to him, oh, I don't think that was too bad. And he looked at her and said, keep it plausible, darling. So keep it plausible is actually quite a good marker for judging these great political moments.
It must be very difficult for you, though, when you're in that situation where it's obvious the whole thing's been a catastrophe, to go out there and try and say that it's not. Do you ever find that difficult? Did you ever find that difficult?
Yes, I did. I did. And I used to be sent out when things were going really bad, when we were in government, as they tended to go sometimes, particularly in the last 3 years of our government. I used to be sent out quite a lot. And so much so that on a Sunday morning, I would rock up to the Sky studio or BBC or whatever it was, and whoever it was would say to me, is it that bad? that was what I felt I had to do.
Were there ever occasions where you just thought, I'm just going to tell the truth? That was awful. Was there ever a point at which you just have that little shred where you just go, look, all right, we all know it was rubbish. I'm not going to come here and pretend otherwise.
Well, you see, what I think happened, Matt, but I was probably anaesthetised, so not fully aware, was that if you were doing Sunday television on Saturday night before what was called the conference call, the number 10 conference call, when anyone who was on a programme would be on this call and you'd be given the line to take. But that was preceded by small microsurgery, when you had a chip implanted in your brain, so that you didn't really need to go on the conference call because you were programmed already. And I do remember when I broke through from that and broke loose, which was probably about 5 years into government. But you see, one of the things I'd say, I remember that's the kind of thing Ed Miliband says. One of the things I'd say. I don't usually talk like that. But when you go as a minister for the first time to do your Today programme interview, and you are a minister in Her Majesty's government, I cannot tell you the weight of responsibility you feel. So you're not going to take any risks and say, oh, this is a rubbish, stupid policy. I mean, I think it's crap, so I don't know why you should think it's of any value. You act as a member of a team, but you have to. And that is, you know, I was very lucky in government because we had, you know, such talent. And so you didn't want to let anybody else down. And I think that that's something which never gets talked about, this sense of responsibility, A, to the position you hold, to the policy it is you're trying to persuade people of the case for, and also the rest of the government.
Did all of your colleagues feel like that about their minister?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say everyone felt like that.
Because I think it's impressive to hear that people, and I think really, I think there's a shallow view that the public like it when people, you know, inverted commas, tell the truth and tell it like it is. But actually, that's only ever a short term hit, isn't it?
You see, sometimes it's just utterly self indulgent, and you know, you can either, you know, you can be the kind of media darling for a day, or the person who speaks his or her mind, the person who doesn't toe the party line. But go back to Dave Brailsford, winning behaviour and losing behaviour. And that's ultimately losing behaviour. Because it may be that you get your place in the sun for a day and you had great headlines and independent-minded and all the rest of it. But actually, it's extremely egocentric, because government can only work if you're prepared to be a member of a team.
But when that team starts to disintegrate, so for instance, if Gordon Brown became leader, and that starts to sort of erode around you, How chaotic was it, like, around the cabinet table when Brown took over? What was, was there a marked change in behaviour from Blair to Brown and the behaviour of other ministers as well?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And it was, for me, it was a very, it was a very strange transition because I'd sort of pretty decided that when Tony stood down, I was going to leave the government as well. But Gordon really, really wanted me to stay. And I, you know, by then we'd won the Olympics and I was so committed to not just, you know, the Olympic Games, but what I thought the Olympics could do for people in the country, that people would discover something about themselves. It would be a sort of sometimes a private discovery, or you're suddenly on the top of the podium having won a gold medal. But this, and I'd like to just talk a bit more about that in a minute, but this sort of unlocking of possibility, which I found so incredibly moving. And, you know, we discovered what Abraham Lincoln would call the better angels of our nature. You know, people felt good. Mm. They felt important. People who normally are just spectators felt that they mattered and they had a part to play. And I sort of encountered that during the torch relay. You know, perhaps you know, some of you were there. But I remember going to watch Seb run, who's a great, great friend of mine. Seb run with the torch in Sheffield, which is his home. And talking to people in the crowd as we were waiting. And a woman said to me, she said, "I'm here because he belongs to our city." And I never thought I mattered. But, you know, it's important that I'm here. Mm. Can you imagine saying that? If you're just, and feeling, you know, you feel that sense of place. And I don't think that that's something that people feel enough, actually. Mm. And, you know, the image I will carry till my dying day will be, it's quite difficult to say this, coming down Cold Harbour Lane in my constituency on on what was called the lead vehicle for the torch relay. And we came round. I don't know if... is anyone here from South London? Yeah. Yes! And so you all know Cold Harbour Lane. Yeah. And coming down Cold Harbour Lane, and there was Brixton out on Cold Harbour Lane. So proud. And, you know, when you have all this stuff about, now, well, what does it mean to be British? You know, those people whose grannies and mothers came from the Caribbean in the late 1940s and throughout the 50s, they were there as South Londoners, so proud of what was happening. And I was in this lead vehicle with Edwin Moses, who's a bit of a legend. And we came round... We came round from the top of Cold Harbour Lane and into Windrush Square. And there were about 200,000 people there. Incredible. For 10 minutes while the Olympic torch came to Brixton. Now, that's what I mean about unlocking that sort of possibility. And that's the, you know, that's what you hope for in politics. And it can happen on that kind of big stage, or it just happens. It happens sort of privately in the classroom, or, you know, somebody, you know, in a hospital, you know, hospital ward, or the sense of discovery that people have about themselves and their possibility. And you put it all together with 200,000 people and you think the year before Brixton, parts of Brixton were in flames with the riots, this sense of disconnection and despair. But there people found the other, the better angels of their nature.
It was amazing. So, in terms of Gordon Brown,
what about Gordon?
Well, just in terms of how the culture changed from Blair to Brown.
I see. That was a bit of a segue. Sorry, I wasn't changing.
It was a good segue.
Subject.
It was a good segue.
I wasn't changing the subject though. I felt slightly when I was in Gordon's cabinet, shall I tell you this story, that, you see, basically he sacked me. Only once, but he said, "I really want you to be Minister for London and Minister for the Olympics," and that's, you know, a big offer, and I said, fine, so, you want me to stay in the cabinet? Oh, no, I can't have you in the cabinet. And I said, well, in that case, I'm not going to, you know, I don't think I should stay. I think you should, you know, you should be able to choose your own people. No. He said, I want you to attend the cabinet. And I said, but not if I'm not in the cabinet. I've been in the cabinet for 6 years, Gordon. Mm. He said, no, I want you to attend the cabinet. He said, nobody will know the difference. So I said, oh, right. I said, fine. And so I was trying to pin down exactly what this meant. And I said, so I thought, this probably sounds a bit crude. I said, so full money then, Gordon? He said, oh, no. They won't let me. But I then felt, and then I phoned Tony. And I phoned a friend. And I said, I'm being a bit revelatory, actually. I think I can't, it's too late to say this is off the record, isn't it?
It's a bit, yeah.
I phoned Tony and I said, Gordon's offered me Minister for London and Minister for the Olympics attending the cabinet. And I said, what do you think I should do? To which he said, well, darling, I think if the Prime Minister asks you to do something, you have to do it. So I said yes.
So he convinced you to serve under Gordon?
So I said yes. And I don't regret it for one moment. I don't regret it for one moment. And, you know, Gordon and I really worked at our relationship.
Well, I wonder what else he asked you to do. Firstly, just on those ministers that attend cabinet but aren't in it, is there then a difference in your relationship with other ministers? Are you allowed to speak if you attend but aren't a member?
Yes, there was one particularly disobliging minister who he'd appointed to his cabinet. And I sat down in... I'm keeping this gender neutral, so you can't guess who it is. Yeah. I sat down in what turned out to be this new cabinet minister's seat.
Okay.
And this new cabinet minister came up to me and said... She was... been very firmly in the other tribe, as it were, said, you're down the bottom. And exactly, pointing to the end of the table.
Why would Yvette Cooper say that to
you? She didn't. It wasn't Yvette. She would never say a thing like that. Anyway, there we are. So that's all, but it all, you know, it all kind of settled down eventually. I want to say this about Gordon, that he was, I mean, I think Gordon was a brilliant chancellor. Yeah. And I used to sit in cabinet and look round the table and think, if I had a ticket to spend an hour with one member of the cabinet talking politics, who would it be? And I always thought it was Gordon, because he did have this incredible kind of intellectual breadth and depth. He put the whole story of what the government was trying to do together. And, I mean, he was really, and at the height of his powers, he was absolutely brilliant. Mm. And I do quite a lot of work in... good.
He's in.
I do a lot of work with African health ministers and African finance ministers, and I do quite a lot in Africa. And Gordon is still a god there because of everything that he did with development, microfinance, malaria. You know, the fact that fewer children are dying of malaria is Gordon. And you know what he had this ability to do was never take no for an answer and grind through, wear people down, you know, until he got to the right result. And in virtually every case, the result was a virtuous result, which was better. I just don't think he should have insisted that Tony Blair stood down as Prime Minister.
So why... Because it was incredible watching the transformation of Gordon Brown, because he was this brilliant shining light, and as someone who was just an observer at the time, was in awe of Gordon Brown. And then as his career developed, he then almost became a sort of Shakespearean tragic figure where he was becoming twisted by jealousy.
And it was terrible, because he... he was a brilliant chancellor, but he didn't know how to be prime minister. And actually, you know, you need to be able to do at least 10 things, and most of them at the same time, if you're Prime Minister. And Gordon couldn't do that. You know, he couldn't let go of the little things in order to focus on the big things. And also, you know, to be absolutely honest, there was such a legacy of toxicity that it was very... I mean, it was extraordinary that we did, you know, as a government, what we did, you know, as much as we did, because there was this fault line.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And then what was it like? So when he was Prime Minister around the cabinet table, did he try and be more friendly with people, or was he awkward?
Well, I mean, to begin with, there was a sense, you know, that you know, this was a big change, and you know, Tony would always say you run out of road as Prime Minister. You know, 10 years is probably as much as you can do, and I think there was a great sense of hope at that time. But being, you know, being Prime Minister relies on building, you know, goes back to teams. First of all, you have to be comfortable with yourself. Mm. Secondly, you have to be, in a strange way, non-tribal, because, you know, you have such an important constitutional position that... you can't just go around sticking your fingers in the eye of the opposition and sort of spitting at them and spitting at the people who don't agree with you. Mm. You have to try and rise above that. And I think that, you know, that Gordon's politics were old-fashioned in that sense. But it's an interesting thing that he's just found himself again. The last 10 days of the referendum campaign, and he just dominated. And there's a lesson really in a lot of politics and achieving political change is filling the space. There is a space and you fill it. You don't ask anybody. You don't you don't expect questions about why you're there. And Gordon just did that in the referendum campaign. Suddenly, from being, you know, miserable and angry with himself in Kirkcaldy, suddenly there he was, dominating this great moment in Scotland's history. And I think that he will continue to dominate the resolution of the post-referendum settlement.
A lot of people say that he could potentially be First Minister, and it's something that he's considering. Do you think that's just gossip? Or
I have absolutely no idea.
So just, it is incredible, isn't it? That one speech made everyone go, oh, God, he's actually great.
Yeah.
It was, and it reminded you of the old Gordon. You're like, he always did have skills, and then there was just that sort of tragic period in his life where he just coincided with him being Prime Minister. And, It was remarkable watching him speak in Scotland.
But actually, you know something, although, I mean, I've had, you know, such rows with Gordon, such arguments with him.
Face to face?
What?
Face to face.
Face to face.
And were they, were they ever scary? Because there were rumours,
weren't
there?
I can tell you about this because this has been documented. But I did say to him in early 2010, that I went to see him to tell him that I thought that he should stand down as leader because we wouldn't win the election if he led us. And I remember I had half an hour between 6 and 6.30 on the 4th of July 2010. It's lodged in my memory. And I got in to his study to see him. And I won't go into everything that passed between us in that half hour. But I remember feeling like I think Tom Daley must feel when he's on a 30-metre diving board. Because Gordon wanted to talk about other things, not what I'd come to talk to him about. And I think he must have had some inkling. And I thought, it's quite a big deal to tell the Prime Minister that you think he ought to stand down. Mm. And I thought, soon I kept on coming and saying, you've got a Ban Ki-moon call at 6.30, and it was already 7 minutes past. And I thought, I felt as if I was looking down, and I was 90 metres up, yeah. And I had to jump. And so I started, and I thought so carefully about what I had to say. And we had a very... he wasn't furious. We had a very engaged conversation. And we did, you know, he said if I was going to stand down, I should have done it last summer. It's too late now. I didn't agree. And I said to him, you know, it isn't fair that people don't get you. But you don't, you know, Tony always used to say to me, if you ever think that I have become a liability to the Labour Party, you must tell me. And then I'll consider what I'm going to do. And I only ever once said to him, you're so far out on a limb. You know, you have a foreign policy that only you support.
Right.
And I remember him looking at me and saying, that's probably right. I felt that I had to say this to Gordon by the same token. Mm. And I think if you're a senior minister and so forth, and I say this now, I would never, ever have said it at the time because it has been documented. Mm. So it is a matter of public record. But this is, you know, I don't think at the time, you know, this sort of exchange should be public. I don't think you should go and chat behind your hand to a friendly journalist who's then going to, give you all sorts of favourable mentions.
Did you ever consider resigning to try and force his hand?
No.
It was never something that was... Because I remember when they had Hazel Blears and James Pennell in the run-up to those local elections, sort of on the day, and it felt like there was a critical mass, and everyone was saying that David Miliband was going to either resign or throw his hat into the ring or challenge Gordon. It felt as if, though, there was almost a pitch invasion mentality where if two or three more would have gone, the floodgates would have opened and everyone would have just...
But nobody was going to, because, I'd had a whole number of conversations. But I don't really want to talk about... I mean, I think this is sort of unnecessarily brutal about Gordon. It was a particularly bad time in what's been a very long political career of Gordon's. And, you know, if Gordon and I had not worked together on Sure Start, we wouldn't have Sure Start. Mm. And he, you know, I will always be grateful that he understood that. He and I had blazing rows about the Olympics, but then when he was, you know, when he really became engaged, he was fantastic and constructive and purposeful. And I think, you know, politics is such a cruel business, Matt. I think that's what it's important to remember. It's important to remember the way Gordon came back last week and just reminded everybody, not that he was just a great orator, but he's a person who's just a profound and passionate patriot. And he did something incredible for Scotland. And, you know, thank goodness, thank you. You know, the United Kingdom owes Gordon a debt for that.
Absolutely. In terms of the Olympics, then, in 2002, you were the only person around the cabinet table advocating it.
Yep.
It was your idea. How much resistance was there in the immediate sense to London putting in a bid for 2012?
A lot.
From everyone around the table.
Absolutely. Why do you want to do that for? It'll be too expensive. You know, we won't win. You know, well, that's a ridiculous idea.
So then, how did you go about convincing? Did you take each cabinet minister in turn?
I think yes, and I think that the important thing with if you're trying to broker and negotiate a decision as big as that, and it was a huge decision for us at the time, you've got to give it time. A lot of bad decisions or decisions are badly taken when you force the pace before people are ready to agree. And so I saw every member of the cabinet, and I also had banked my gang. And you know, you always, this is the other thing I always say to people about politics, that you should, that's Ed Miliband again, you see, very powerful influence.
Do you think, there's an interesting point there, though, isn't there, about political language and how it, a culture just sort of adopts phrases,
yes,
and body language. Because a lot of people think that, oh, politicians are taught to sound in a particular way or move in a particular way. But the reality is, if you're surrounded by people who talk like that all the time, you just end up...
I know, this is a bit of a segue away from the Olympics, but... I sometimes feel a prisoner of that, and I just want to get out and stop using all this kind of political bollocks. You know, it's but you do. It is like a language that you learn, and everybody starts talking in the same language, and you understand each other. But it isn't how real people speak. You know, I don't talk to people like that when I meet them at the bus stop or knocking on their doors in my constituency. And I listened to myself the other day. I know, I was on Daily Politics and I was talking about the Scottish referendum. And I think I was so bad and unpersuasive and unconvincing. And I grew up in Scotland. I mean, this is not something that I felt entirely indifferent to at all. And I thought, why can't I break out of this language? Nobody would have seen, you know, this kind of language, this conversation I was having with myself in my head. And, of course, the cybernats spat on me, you know, across
metaphorically.
Twitter. Metaphorically. Well, and, you know, you know how they do, in Twitter. So I think that it is, one of the things that is a risk in politics that, you know, I think... You know, I really just try to talk like I've always talked. And then sometimes I just hear myself talk. My kids say this to Mum, you're just talking like a politician. And then I don't. But then it creeps back again. And I think I think there's a great deal of ambivalence about what kind of politicians we want, actually. Mm. And I was doing a phone-in recently, and it was very, very clear. Do you want politicians who are exactly like you? I was getting on the bus this morning, and the man behind me said, it's very nice to see you use the bus. And I felt like saying, well, what else, how else do I get to work then?
But they presume you've got chauffeur-driven cars.
I used to. I had my driver, Delroy. My driver Delroy for 4 years, and when we had a very tearful parting at the time of the election, and he'd driven me into the cabinet, and then the government fell, and it was quite clear that there was going to be a coalition. And I remember Radio 5 Live phoned me and said, Mr. Charles, can we do an interview with you about the fall of the government? Can you just tell us where you are? And I said, I'm on the 214 bus. But Delroy and I, you develop such a close relationship with, you know, I did 13 years in government with my driver. And it's quite domestic, really. And we used to buy soft mints every week. And we used to take it in turns about who was going to buy the soft mints for the car. And from time to time, Delroy's now a private chauffeur, I get home and in my letterbox there's a tube of soft mints.
Oh, he's haunting you. It's like the end of The Sixth Sense. Devilry never existed.
No, he did. He always did. To any of you, listen to Eddie Nestor on BBC London. Eddie was always a great friend of Delroy, so we always had a message for Delroy while he was waiting outside while I was in the studio. She won't be long, Delroy!
we'll come back to the interviews, but just on the coalition stuff, did you ever feel that Labour should have tried to negotiate themselves into coalition?
I think we should have done. But we didn't. I think we should have tried harder. My last question in Cabinet was to say to Gordon, who is your negotiating team for the coalition? And he kind of looked at me as if, why did you ask that question? But I don't think we ever really tried. But that said, I think you can sell too much in coalition negotiations. And I think it's sort of killed the Liberal Democrats for a very long time. And I think that the... Is that a Liberal Democrat waking up?
The smart chap just there in his three-piece.
Oh, right. I think there's a lot of... You know, if we are the largest party, if we don't win outright the next election, if we were the largest party, should we enter into coalition with the Liberal Democrats? And I think that is, at this stage, an unanswerable question. And I think there's almost...
Axel was going to ask it.
Well, let me give you the best answer I can, which is that just supposing the Liberal Democrats have lost half their seats, is it kind of morally right? to bestow on them the responsibility of government?
But it's parliamentary arithmetic, isn't it? I mean, you could say, would it be morally right for the parties that finished second and third last time to have formed a government?
Yeah, which is why it isn't only a question of arithmetic. Yeah. I think there's also a question of decency. And I think people are very, you know, the people who elect us are very live to that. And, you know, I think... maybe if we're the largest party, but we don't command an overall majority, then, you know, there is this thing which is called confidence and supply, which is that you reach agreement with the minority parties that certain manifested commitments will be met. Okay. And it almost inevitably means that there'll be another election before very long. But I think it's impossible to answer these questions, yeah, Matt, at this stage.
So back to the Olympics, you ended up working very closely. One of the things that really impressed me about Seb Coe and Jeremy Hunt was that when the new government came in, they very much kept you on at the heart of things. What was it like then dealing with Tories as a job?
Well, I mean,
there's many that I really like.
Well, I think they were very...
Some of my best friends are Tories.
Yeah. and actually, Seb is one of my closest friends, and I became very close friends with Hugh Robertson, who was the minister who really did most for the Tories on the Olympics. Very, very close with him. And the thing is that we were bound by this sense of passion that we had about what it was we were together creating. And it really was like that. I do remember, though, Seb and I were going to run the marathon together to mark the Olympics in 2012. And I texted him towards the end of 2011 to say, shouldn't we be getting into training? And he phoned me up and said, Tessa, my knees are just not up to it. And then we were both opening the new sport and fitness centre at UCH. This is roll forward 2 years. And the surgeon, because I've had trouble with my knee, was this genius who has created this sport and fitness exercise centre, state of the art for, you know, just weekend joggers or Cristiano Ronaldo. No, except not there, because it's an AHS hospital. Anyway, I remember Seb and I were both at the opening, and rather solicitously, the head of UCH said we were talking about our knees, and this wonderful surgeon, in response to the question about how my knees were, surgeon answered for me, he said, "We're coping." But he did say he thought Seb and I had one good knee between us. So just as well we didn't run the marathon.
Did you have to deal with Boris much during the Olympics?
I did, yes. And I dealt with Boris a lot during the Olympics. And Boris, when he first arrived after he'd defeated Ken, was a bit like a cuckoo in the nest, because he was slightly our functional outgroup. Because we were all, you know, we were hurtling towards 2012 at this point. And, you know, he wanted to do, there must be lots of money that's being wasted, squandered away in this socialist project. And, you know, all that. So we actually just let him do that. And, of course, he discovered that there wasn't any money being squandered. You know, it was all very tightly tied down. And then he, you know, Boris did actually become a team player. And one of the things that he did understand, and I would not have been able to do this without his support, he did understand which other members of the kind of close Olympic team didn't understand in the same way, was democracy. And we had five Olympic boroughs that were benefiting. Very, very poor boroughs were benefiting from the kind of Olympic gold dust. And I really wanted Barking to become an Olympic borough and to have a big Olympic facility that would, you know, give a real kickstart to economic regeneration after the Games, but also spread some of the, you know, this sort of magic that the Olympics brought. And nobody else wanted it, but Boris got the point. And he and I just kind of drove that through. But he got the point about democracy. And I'm not one of these people who you know, cuss Boris. I think that he is, he caught the zeitgeist at the moment.
Yeah.
And he has broken lots of the commitments he made. He's reduced police numbers, hasn't built homes. His emission zone is a disaster. But in a way, that isn't what Boris is in politics for. You know, he just isn't. And I mean, I think that the kind of legacy image of Boris is we're holding two Union Jacks on a zip wire, and you know, and it was a phenomenon during the Olympics that whenever he appeared, everybody started cheering and wanted to take pictures of him.
Do you think some politicians envy that he can be so gaffe-prone and almost so willfully destructive at times of his own reputation, and yet the more he seems to almost deliberately mess it up, the more the public love him? And, you know, when you say about being on the Daily Politics and listening to yourself speak and thinking, why am I speaking like this? You look at Boris, who's invented his own style and is flourishing. Is that something that you envy sometimes?
No. Well, you see, I think, this sounds very dreary, I think politics is a very serious business, actually. Mm. And I think that I'm always slightly uneasy about mix, you know, when politicians want to become celebrities. And, you know, I was asked to do Strictly Come Dancing for Sport Relief. You know, when we were doing, you know, in about years ago, long time ago, when I had two decent knees. and I thought, you know, what'll happen, you know, if I do Strictly? And I was quite tempted. And I thought, if I do it and I have to rehearse for, you know, 7 hours a week or more, they'll say, you know, the silly bitch, she, you know, she, look at her on Strictly Come Dancing when she should be sorting out the Olympic budget. Mm. And that's what I was, that was my job. I'm not, you know, I'm not a kind of television star. I was there to make the Olympics work. And, you know, sitting, you know, going through all the routines that you have to do when you're delivering policy. So I suppose that's what I think. And, you know, my great advice, strong advice to Boris would be, don't become leader of the Tory party. I think that he's, you know, he has carved out a niche. I think that he has brought sort of zeitgeist. He did capture the zeitgeist of London, but he's not somebody. He is an entertainer. He's actually got a lot of warmth. I like him actually. I've known him for a very, very long time. I do like him. But I think he'd be a terrible prime minister. Because being a prime minister, you know, going back to what I was saying about Gordon and Tony, you know, it's really hard work. And every day, you know, you don't know whether you're going to have to deal with some, you know, terrible hostage taking or, you know, a school that's been, you know, there's been some scandal in relation to, or one of your ministers has got into, you know, terrible trouble, or maybe we're about to go to war. You know, this is what you have to deal with day in, day out. And it is the serious business of government. And so that's why, not that he'll listen to me, I would say to him, don't do it, Boris.
Did you ever want to be Prime Minister?
Do you know, I've never wanted to be Prime Minister. I suppose I've always, and this may be, you know, I kind of can't quite believe it.
What, that you weren't?
No. that I was what I was, you know. I never thought I would be in the Cabinet or in the government, or even that I'd become a Member of Parliament. And that's why, you know, one of the things I've always felt every day is a sense of awe that I am and that I represent 80,000 people. And it's not something that I feel a shred of cynicism about. And, you know, I think that being elected and being charged of that responsibility is a kind of sacred responsibility, actually. And it's why I just hate this devaluing and degrading of politics and politicians. You know, I was absolutely furious last week that there was a poster advertising Andrew Marr's book in Westminster Tube Station. And I can't remember exactly, I was so angry, because it sort of said, you know, a novel of intrigue, you know, power, ruthlessness, and corruption. Westminster, so business as usual then. And it isn't. You know, it isn't. There, you know, after the expenses scandal, 6 MPs went to prison. And because, you know, so you know, 1%. Of a workforce of 650 went to prison because they had done something very, very bad. But I just don't think that the presumption, the public presumption, should be that the other 644, you know, are shysters who are only in it for themselves and all the rest of it. You know, and I think that decency in politics is a really important thing, and that sense of belief in what politics can do. And, you know, my first job was as a childcare officer in Brixton, and then I became, and then I was a psychiatric social worker working at the Maudsley. And I think I was pretty good at it, and I could actually change the pattern of people's lives. And, you know, I remember one lady, and I can see her flat now in the middle, what is now the middle of my constituency, and she would never go out. She had no gas. She had no electricity. I don't know how she had running water. She had no furniture. And, I mean, she had a severe and profound mental illness. And I used to go and visit her twice a week for about 3 months. And after about 3 months, she agreed to let me in, and her flat was indescribable. And we made a relationship that in the end meant that she agreed to come with me to Bonmarsh in Brixton to buy a bed, and, you know, so that she didn't sleep on the floor anymore and so forth. And I thought, you know, I can do that. But actually the big solutions to the life of someone like her, the solutions that politics gives. And I did, you know, when I was at the Maudsley, I did a lot of psychotherapeutic training, and I was actually going to become an analyst. I trained as a family therapist, and I I've always been very interested in, you know, and throughout my political life, I've been struck by, you know, the power of intended and unintended human behaviour. Mm. And one of the things that I learned, which is a parallel between politics and that kind of empathy, connection with people, is that people have got to be ready for what it is as a politician you have to say. And if they're not ready, then there's no public resonance. And to go right back to what we were saying at the beginning, Matt, I think it'll be quite interesting to see how in the long run, you know, Ed's much mocked and panned speech lives in people's minds. Mm. Not his delivery and, you know, all the rest of it, but the fact that you might just not have to wait so long to see your doctor. And, you know, if you've got a 13-year-old who's not doing very well at school, that they might really get an apprenticeship. So, you know, these are the things by which I think in the private world of the people who lined the Olympic torch relay route in Brixton and in Sheffield, you know, these are the things that sometimes we don't account for.
It's quite rare to see a politician so emotional about representing people. I don't think I've ever seen that before. It's amazing to see. Given that you're such a gifted politician, have such a connection with people, would you consider running for Mayor of London?
Yes. Would I consider running as Mayor of London?
Yeah.
I'd consider it.
That does feel like an excuse.
Wouldn't I be mad not to consider it?
I think you would. I think just you would just be the best Mayor of London we could ever have.
Oh, okay.
I think, but it feels like that's... Oh, my word. Right, I'm going to... I'll open up the floor to questions. Now, Tris has got a roving mic, so I'll try and sort of to save him running right across the room. Okay, we'll start with the chap at the back because he's very passionate. If we could ask for so we can get as many people in.
Hello?
One sentence questions and one sentence answers,
it's
please.
Not going to be one sentence, but listen, you speak very passionately, and I really applaud you as a Labour member. And Gordon Brown, for me, was a great politician up until he kind of changed his mind. But how did you feel about the Labour Party in Scotland standing on the same ticket as the Tories, UKIP and the Orange Order?
You mean as part of the...
Yeah, and...
the Better Together campaign.
And you spoke about Better Angels. You know, do you not think it's better for people to determine their own future rather than to have other people determine their future?
I think sometimes the there are interests which transcend tribalism. And I think you see increasingly... I mean, I've been a member of the Labour Party for 45 years. I fought 12 elections. I was a councillor for 15 years and I will have been a Member of Parliament for 23 years. And I am Labour in every fibre of my body, but I'm much less tribal than I used to be. And I think that you can often build the basis of solid, long-term change if you work with people who don't necessarily share your politics.
But it was a magic convenience.
They may share your values. I mean, you build a coalition of values.
We need to get around other people, mate, because you had three questions already. And, you know, I think you've had a fair answer, to be fair.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, you don't think I... You can think you've had a fair answer, do you?
No, but I think I believe that they were the right people.
No, don't apologise. Perfectly legitimate. Okay, is anyone in this section of them that's got a question? The gentleman at the front. Yeah, Tristan. Cheers, there we go. The UKIP guy.
Well, actually, listening to Tess this evening's made me remember why I used to be a member of the Labour Party.
We've got another exclusive.
Come back.
But maybe a little bit more flippant than the guy at the back, but... Of the 650 MPs in the House of Commons, who, given your personal up-close experience with them, would make the best Prime Minister at the moment?
Good question.
who do I think would make the best Prime Minister at the moment?
Excluded.
I think... well, I mean, let's exclude all the, you know, the existing the existing leaders, because I actually think that if Ed is given the chance, I think he'll be a very good Prime Minister. I think he'll be a very good Prime Minister. And who do I think would be? You see, I tell you what I think the problem is. That there are a lot of young people. We've got some, I think we've got some fantastically talented MPs who are coming up, but they're not ready to be Prime Minister yet. You know, you have to have lived and you have to have had, you know, at times, you know, Blair said, at the end of 10 years, he said, you know, I feel, you know, I'm leaving just as I feel I now know how to do the job. Mm-hmm. And that's the, you know, that's the that's the paradox. And I think I don't fully understand how difficult being Prime Minister is. You know, I was a Secretary of State and I did a lot else beyond being a departmental Secretary of State. I did all the humanitarian support for families after 9/11, after 7/7, you know, and so forth. But, you know, they will be great in five or so years' time. Somebody who would run a mile at the thought of being Prime Minister is Alan Johnson. And I think Alan has... He's done a lot, and I'll tell you why. I don't think Alan often has my daily politics moment, which is, why do I keep talking like this? because I think he has a tremendous fluency. I think he's incredibly at ease and comfortable with himself. And, you know, his book is incredibly moving, isn't it? A Boy. And he... So I think Alan could be Prime Minister. And I think he'd be a very... I think, you see, the greatly undervalued quality of modern politics is emotional intelligence and empathy. And I think if you can't be empathetic with the people that you serve and the people that you represent, then you're only talking with kind of half your person, as it were.
There's a chap at the back with a beard, I think. No beard.
So
you should
just
grow
to,
one.
I might. Just to build on your answer to the last question, it seems that elsewhere in the world that it's very common for politicians or prime ministers or presidents to be in their 60s, and yet we seem to be focusing on leaders who are in their 40s. You talked about emotional intelligence and other experience, such as Alan Johnson. Do you think we'll ever return to a stage where we look to people with much more experience in the real world?
I think it's a very good idea to look to older people with bus passes to carry great responsibility. But also, by the same token, I don't think you should pretend that you're 21 and you're kind of out with the youth. I mean, I think you just have to, you know, I think there is, you know, I think experience is so important. You know, I wish I'd known 25 years ago when I first stood for Parliament, you know, what I know now. And it's one of the reasons that I love mentoring our candidates and just downloading, you know, what I've learned, because I sort of feel it helps them cut some corners that I kind of had to walk all the way around. So I think that is important. I think experience is important, and I think it's important to share your experience and be generous about it.
Right, we've got time for one more. Has anyone got a burning question that they absolutely must? The gentleman there. What's the question?
You said earlier that only 1% of politicians were actually convicted and went to prison for expense scandals. What percentage of politicians do you think, honestly, are as passionate about representing constituents as you are?
Great question.
are as passionate about rep. Well, you know, I could give you a long list of people. I think you have to assume the vast majority of people are passionate about their constituents and their constituencies. And, you know, it's what gives you... I mean, it's like, you know, especially if you become a minister, you become a Secretary of State, your constituency is your docking station. And, you know, one of the things that is really important to do is to sort of protect the time that you spend in your constituency. And there's a bit of my constituency that I drive into, and it's down... anyone live in Herne Hill here? Yeah. Yes! So you know the bottom of Milkwood Road. And that was my kind of Friday morning moment when I got down to the bottom of Milkwood Road and just felt, you know, it was just that kind of, you know, here I am. And I have just always found the most kind of revitalising thing when you feel depleted by all the kind of, you know, the grind of you know, just difficult ministerial jobs is sitting down with a group of the people you represent and listening to them and listening to their wisdom and their generosity and their reasonableness and sometimes their anger, but just listening to them, and you just feel recharged by that.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the evening. My next guest in October is Michael Portillo. and then Luciana Berger in November, and more guests to be announced early for next year. Before we go, please thank John, Sound and Tris and all the bar staff here at the St. James' Theatre.
Just before Matt closes, I want Duncan Chapman and Shamir Patel, who are two of the people who run my constituency office, and Catherine Dawson, who's one of my caseworkers, my constituents' caseworkers, to stand up and take a bow.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end. Tessa, by far, one of the best guests we've ever had here.
And, thank you.
By far, one of the most just authentic. It's incredible. Because I still get cynical about politics, particularly having spent, you know, a few days at the Labour Party conference. it's so reassuring to know, I think, for all of us. It's so reassuring to know that there are people like you that are still in leading roles. You. Ladies and gentlemen, Tessa Zhao.
Well, there you go. What's so surreal, obviously, is given the history of the show, some of the people I've interviewed are no longer with us, and that is very, very sad. But what's so special is to have a record of particularly someone like Tessa Jowell, who was so special, to have a record that really captures her personality. And obviously, there are a variety of things you can find out about Tessa, but to have a long interview with her where she really shows you what is special about her is, I just feel so privileged that I was sat next to her for that, and what a way to start this. So you may never have heard that before if you've come to the podcast in the last few years, so I had to open with Tessa. She remains just a complete hero, and I mean, that was in 2014, so we just had the independence referendum in Scotland, but Brexit and Corbyn and all the things, Trump, you think about what's happened to British politics since. And there are signs that it's improving, but really it's been through hell. And what an antidote to that period Tessa Jowell would have been. But her spirit, her character lives on. And what a treat that was for all of us. So thank you for downloading this. You can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for all of you that have. And I'm on Twitter at Matt Ford. I will periodically be on there, I think. I mean, I just don't know. But I plan to be on there from time to time and messaging people and keeping people up to date a little bit. And obviously, if I've got the energy and I've got the concentration, commenting on politics. But that's quite enough for me for today. I hope you've enjoyed this first of this, especially I want to say curated. I've basically just gone through and picked out my favourites, but curated somehow makes it sound more highbrow. So thank you for downloading this, and I'll see you next time. It's all right.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.